Hi, everyone. Welcome to the podcast. I'm here today with Romina Bocha. Romina, can you introduce yourself a little bit for the audience?
Yes. My name is Romina Bocha. I'm the Director of Federal Budget and Entitlement Policy at the Cato Institute. Previously, I was at the Heritage Foundation, where our team worked on the executive budget proposal. And my primary goal at Cato right now, and what I've become known for, is pushing for a congressional fiscal commission that is modeled after the Base Realignment and Closure Commission in order to solve the entitlement spending challenge.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting. I didn't know you worked at Heritage. When did you leave them?
In 2020.
Okay. So do they still care about entitlements or government spending?
I do have some colleagues there that are writing about this, care about this. They've done a lot of work looking back at how much spending happened during the pandemic and how it's impacted inflation. You do see more of a focus at Heritage now on identifying particular types of spending and calling out, you know, smaller budget items that can get people more riled up. So they've been fighting the woke bureaucracy, for example, much more heavily than my focus is more on how do we resolve the Medicare and Social Security spending challenge, which is less politically popular, but is, you know, far more important in terms of resolving what's really driving us deeper into debt. But yeah, they're still focused on it, but you do also see a lot more politically focused messaging, I would say, to get people on board with spending reductions around issues they find more controversial or provocative, if you will.
Yeah, and that's interesting because it's a question of whether that's like a good strategy. Like, do you see it as like they are just becoming culture warriors, like in their heads? All, and this could apply to people in Congress too, who are spending hawks. Are they just in their heads becoming more popular, so all they can think about is DEI or Trump's prosecutions or whatever? Or do you see that there's people in Washington who actually have a strategy to get people riled up about DEI or whatever, and then hopefully use it to do, you know, more substantial things?
Probably a little bit of both, depending on, you know, who is doing the work in the organization. I do think that the strategy to try and get people riled up about culturally focused spending to oppose, you know, major new spending bills like we're dealing with this week with appropriations, or to try to build public support for, you know, like kind of like what the Tea Party was in 2010 for spending reductions and debt reductions that really put pressure on Congress at the time, John Boehner, to negotiate with President Obama and got us the Budget Control Act. Like, that can be a winning strategy. What we find is that very few people realize that the primary challenge with the federal budget is Medicare and Social Security. And even if they understand that, it's against their self-interest in many cases to really grapple with that reality. And so it's very difficult to get people to coalesce, to call for spending cuts and debt restraint when you make it about these very popular issues. You have a much higher likelihood of getting their support when you make it about, you know, even though it's smaller budgetary items, but things that are symbolic and that highlight that the federal government spending is overreaching, is involved in issues that the federal government shouldn't be involved with to begin with. So you make it about the scope of government spending rather than the overall size. So, you know, it's difficult to convince people that you need to reform very beloved benefit programs that have broad bipartisan support while you're spending money on a lot of things that many people find objectionable. So highlighting those objectionable spending items can get people, you know, more involved in pushing for broader spending restraint.
Yeah, that makes sense. You have a Substack too, called Debt Dispatch. And the other day you pointed out that 100% of our unfunded spending is going to be Social Security and Medicare. That's it. And we actually, interestingly, you said we have a surplus if you cut out Social Security and Medicare in the long run, right? So can you just talk about, like, that blows people, I think that would blow people's mind. I think most people wouldn't think that. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Yes, there's this report that the Treasury puts out every year. It's called the Financial Report of the U.S. Government. It gets very little attention in the popular press and the media. I saw like two mentions of it this year, and mostly by other fiscal scholars. What this report does, it looks at the next 75 years of government spending and revenue projections, and then the gap between what the government will spend and what it will collect in taxes under current policy, and given what we assume about what interest rates will be, et cetera. That's the so-called unfunded obligation in this case, because it's negative. And so over the next 75 years, they've identified a $73 trillion unfunded obligation. And then you can parse that into what's driving that unfunded obligation. And if you look at the entitlement side of the budget, primarily Medicare and Social Security, and you look at the revenues that these programs are projected to collect in order to be funded, you find that actually the entire unfunded obligation is due to Medicare and Social Security. In fact, the Medicare and Social Security unfunded obligation is roughly $78 trillion. So it's $5 trillion more than the total unfunded obligation. It's like, well, how can it be more than 100%? And that's exactly right. What you pointed out is that the other aspects of the budget actually are running a $5 trillion surplus, which then reduces the Medicare and Social Security unfunded obligation. I think the big takeaway here is that over the long term, it doesn't matter what spending cuts Republicans are demanding at this point. If it's not about slowing the growth in spending for Medicare and Social Security, these are largely symbolic, or they're more focused on getting the government out of doing certain things that it shouldn't be doing, but it's not going to resolve the looming fiscal crises, because that is primarily driven by Medicare and Social Security. Actually, two-thirds of it is Medicare. And those numbers are also somewhat more uncertain, because with Social Security, you can fairly easily figure out the math. You look at your demographics, how your benefit formula works, and then, you know, unless you have major changes in immigration or fertility, you can project those figures with relative certainty. But with Medicare, a lot of it is the growth in healthcare spending, in addition to, you know, who will be eligible to receive those benefits. Some other uncertainties come in terms of what the government will agree to cover. We have this debate now with the weight loss drug Ozempic, for example, whether government should be covering drugs like this, and how to make those decisions. So there's a lot more uncertainty in that. But overall, those are the primary drivers of our debt. I would like to say, though, that one thing that the Treasury does not project is government's propensity to spend a lot of money during emergencies. Like, the biggest spending blowouts we've seen in U.S. history have been related to major unexpected crises, like the COVID-19 pandemic, which is the only other time the government spent as much during a crisis was during World War II. But then also, whenever you have a recession, you find that there's a lot more government spending that significantly increases the debt. In fact, backward looking, just over the last 30 years, we can attribute about 50% of the total public debt right now to spending during crises. And that's something that the government does not project. So assuming no major crises under current policy, Medicare and Social Security are the key drivers. But this also tells you that you don't really have much fiscal space to respond to major crises if you're already digging a hole that's, you know, $73 trillion deep with projections of debt as a percentage of GDP reaching over 500%, which is, you know, probably not something that the United States, even with the U.S. dollar as a reserve currency, is going to be able to sustain without a severe fiscal crisis. So it would, in order to create that fiscal space to respond to unexpected crises, the government really needs to address Medicare and Social Security, which are the most predictable drivers of the growth in the debt now.
Yeah. I mean, it's a sort of opposite view of what people's views on government. So most people like Social Security and Medicare, and then they think everything else is so out of control and crazy. But like, if you just bracket Social Security and Medicare, our government is completely fiscally responsible. It's very good. It has surplus, you know, projected over the next 75 years. So it's just insane how much the public perception is just not connected to reality.
You know, some of it, I think, is because these programs, Medicare and Social Security, have been sold to the American people in a way that there is this myth that they are fully self-funded, that you pay for your own benefits, that mm-hmm. these are savings programs rather than, mm-hmm. you know, government benefit programs. So people really feel like it's a government is just, you know, collecting their savings on their behalf and then giving it back to them when they retire, which is obviously not how the program works and how it never worked previously. But that myth is a very, very powerful myth. And if you think about when Social Security was first adopted in 1935, which, by the way, is almost 90 years ago now, it was very difficult to sell the American public, even in the aftermath of the Great Depression, on the idea that government would provide a welfare program. Like, that wasn't something that would have been politically popular at the time. There was this ethic of you work hard, you take care of yourself and your family, and you don't want to be a burden on anyone else, including your fellow citizens. And so when you look at the political narrative behind Social Security, it was really about, no, this is an earned benefit. Like, you're paying into this, and then you'll draw down from it in the future, which today, given all of the vehicles individuals have for saving in ways that are automatic, by default, in ways where you don't have to be a financial expert in order to invest, say, in index funds, for example, where you can participate in the gains to the economy, it really doesn't make much sense for the government, which most people recognize is actually not overall fiscally responsible and can be quite reckless, to store your savings on your behalf. But that is that long-held belief. So I think that explains a lot of the support for these programs, and people have a hard time wrapping their heads around the fact that those are the major drivers of our debt. It's like, how could that be if we've paid for them?
Yeah, I mean, that talking point is very common. I know, like, if I go on Twitter and I say something about Social Security and Medicare, they'll be like, no, that's different. People paid for it, right? That it's like, if they paid for it, then it would be solvent. You wouldn't have a problem, right? Obviously, that's not how it works. Sometimes when I talk to people in DC, they seem to use like the unpopularity of cutting these programs as an excuse to do nothing. But something that you were sort of getting at right now is that it's unpopular to cut them because of the way we've talked about them. I mean, it's sort of circular. We tell people Social Security and Medicare are so great. They're just, we're giving them the myth that it's just a savings program, that you're getting your own money back. It has no problems. We don't say it's bankrupting the country or anything. And then of course these programs are popular because nobody is willing to talk about them. So do you ever think about sort of how popular these programs are and like how connected that is with the fact that everyone's afraid to talk about them?
Yes, that is the key challenge. I do think, however, that there are inroads that we could make if we emphasize, for example, just how generous these benefits are for some of the wealthiest income earners in the United States, and how that is in stark contrast, say, with other countries that also have programs similar to Social Security. Because in the United States today, the highest earning couple that qualifies for the maximum benefit can collect well above $100,000 a year from Social Security. And they also, people in the higher income cohorts also tend to disproportionately use Medicare because they can access a lot of services by being willing to, cover the copay and buy supplemental plans, but still they end up using a lot more of the Medicare benefit than, say, the more vulnerable, lower income individuals for whom these programs were perhaps originally intended, or that's at least the narrative. that we hear often. And so I think there is actually an opportunity to tap into some of the instincts that people have, a sense of fairness and justice, to point out that it doesn't make sense to ask lower net worth, lower earning American families that are struggling to, you know, buy a home, pay off their car, start a family, to pay higher taxes, or even just the current tax burden that they're bearing, in order to subsidize the retirement of much wealthier individuals purely by the fact that they are older. And so that isn't being leveraged enough. But I do think that you could get people to support broad changes to the programs that would target benefits more towards vulnerable beneficiaries who need support from the government more than others, that because perhaps they've had, you know, lower earnings over their entire lifetimes, where they weren't able to save as much as, say, more higher earning individuals. And also to make the case that, you know, some seniors, perhaps their benefits are too low, and you could build public support to reduce benefits for the highest earners, maybe increase them some for populations that are more vulnerable, and actually get a bipartisan coalition. But we haven't seen that openness. It's sort of like both parties prefer the status quo, and that's causing gridlock. But the issue is, and a lot of people aren't honest about this, is that the status quo comes with a high price. And that price is lower economic growth and lower incomes for Americans across the board, and most likely recurring bouts of inflation in the near term, as interest rates going up, eventually even more than we've already seen as a result of investors catching on that the federal government is not willing to, you know, deal with its unfunded obligations, but that investors may eventually get stuck holding the bag. They're going to demand higher interest rates, and if the Treasury will have trouble to service the debt at those higher rates, it's not out of the question that the Federal Reserve will step in and basically float that credit to the Treasury, creating new money in order to support current government spending. And we saw how that worked out. During the pandemic, we had inflation at a 40-year high, which, with the Federal Reserve still now years in, trying to fight this inflation and get it down to their target rate. So there is a high cost. It's just that it's not as directly related to, say, you know, people receiving lower benefits in the future than they are right now, which seems much more tangible than to say everything is going to cost more money and you're going to have less income to pay for it. And so your living standard is going to be lower and it will be depressed. And that's sort of like the more middling scenario where a severe fiscal crisis potentially could be much, much worse than even that, you know, very, very gloomy scenario of lower incomes and higher inflation.
Yeah, you've touched on the political issue in Washington and how the parties are dealing with it. I see on the Republican side not a lot of seriousness, but occasionally someone will broach the topic. Someone like Nikki Haley will say, mm-hmm. we might want to think about down the line raising the retirement age. And sometimes Trump will say something and then say something else. And then on the Democratic side, what you talked about cutting benefits potentially for the wealthiest seniors, seems like that's something that in theory should be up their alley. I don't hear any Democrats or sort of any left-wing intellectuals even considering any kind of cuts to Social Security and Medicare. Am I wrong on that? Is there any sort of movement on that side to think seriously about these issues?
Not in a public way, but if you talk to folks doing policy on the left in a private setting, they're more amenable to those discussions, but publicly they will not admit that they would consider any reductions to those benefits. So I think that in a scenario where you have both parties working together to find a solution, which they eventually will have to do, most likely over the next 10 years with Social Security's trust fund running out by 2033. Now, it's not really a trust fund in the sense that it doesn't have real assets, but it does create a legislative deadline where automatic benefit cuts of 23% across the board would take place. So that's going to create that political deadline where the parties will come together in some form to address the issue. And I think in those more closed door negotiations, you will find more openness on the left to reducing benefits for the highest earners. But I have found that the left is particularly strong in sticking to one message and singing from the same song sheet. And I think that's really aided them politically in getting their way. It's very clear to people where the left stands on these benefit programs. They want to expand them to the degree that they've introduced bills that would address, say, Social Security. It's always benefit increases, usually across the board, and then raising taxes on higher income earners. In some form, reducing benefits for higher income earners is a tax increase by other means. It's just a way to reduce, if you will, their return on the taxes that they paid in the past. But you're also reducing government spending overall instead of asking them to pay more and continuing to give them also more benefits. So I do think that there is room for negotiation there. But especially this year, you're not going to hear much about any real solutions because it's all political talking points and trying to signal, especially to older voters who tend to disproportionately show up to vote compared to younger generations, that you should vote for me because I have your best interest in mind. And when I say disproportionately vote, in the 2020 presidential election, 72% of eligible voters over age 65 showed up to vote. If you compare that to the 18 to 24 year cohort, fewer than half of those eligible voters showed up to vote. So older individuals are making their voices heard more effectively in our political process. They're more likely to vote. They're more likely to contact their members of Congress. They're more likely to be part of special interest organizations, in part because they have more time on their hand. They're not busy, you know, working jobs and taking care of their families. And so politicians, understandably, will cater to their needs in a disproportionate fashion because they're just a much more powerful voting bloc, despite being a smaller portion of the population, but they're also growing. We're going now from about 15% of the population being 65 and older to, over the next 5 years, 20% of the population will be 65 and older. So there's a rapid aging going on, and it's reflected in the politics that we see.
Yeah, so that's, you know, a pretty pessimistic sort of view on the politics and the general demographic trajectory of the country. But one thing I like about your work is it's actually a little more optimistic than a lot of people who write about entitlements and long-term spending trends, in that you have a solution, which is debt commissions. Just tell us what debt commissions are and how they can sort of get around some of these problems.
Yes. So basically, I've been grappling with this problem for the past 15 years, and it's only gotten worse since. And so trying to get creative with how can we actually resolve this. Like, initially, I thought if we just educate members of Congress and the public, perhaps we can make some headway. But that wasn't really the key to the issue. And so I was thinking of a quote by Milton Friedman, where he said something along the lines of, you have to make it politically profitable for the wrong people to do the right thing. And so how do you make entitlement reform politically profitable? There isn't like an obvious path there. Voters do tend to reward politicians who demonstrate fiscal responsibility. So there is a payoff to that. But voters tend to broadly support reducing the deficit or controlling the debt. But once you get into the details, that's where you lose them. So the best way to approach this, what seems like an intractable political problem now, to reform Medicare and Social Security, I think, is actually to emphasize the potential benefit of reducing the debt, avoiding a severe fiscal crisis, ensuring broadly shared economic growth, keeping inflation in check by controlling the growth in the debt. And so a debt commission can focus on that big picture goal without having to get into the details, because you leave the details up to the commissioners. And so that's one of the key aims here. If you also look at other countries that have, for example, adopted spending limits, like Switzerland, that was sold to their to the public as a debt break. And it is, it acts as such, but it actually limits the growth in the debt by directly limiting spending. But it might not have been as politically popular if it had been framed as a spending limit. Instead, by focusing on controlling the growth in the debt, you got much more broad support. I want to say 85% of Swiss voters voted in that referendum for the debt break. Similar in the United States, we see when you ask people if they think both parties should work together to control the growth in the debt, you get 85 to 90% support. Both voters on both sides agree that that is a worthwhile goal. So you can set up a mechanism where lawmakers vote for putting in place a debt commission that addresses that problem and then leaves the details up to the commissioners. But I think there's more details that matter here, because how do you get that political cover for politicians to do something that seems like it would be political suicide, addressing the growth in benefits in Medicare and Social Security, maybe also some tax increases, but tax increases will only get you so far. So it will have to come down to reducing the growth in spending on these programs. And so there I've looked at, you know, what's another intractable political problem that the United States was able to overcome. And that was closing obsolete military bases after the Cold War. That turned out to be a very difficult problem. No member of Congress wanted to close a base in their district. You know, other bases, sure, maybe those are obsolete, but not mine. And so they would collude in order to prevent any bases from being closed. Come into play the Base Realignment and Closure Commission, which was an attempt to overcome this political issue, and it worked. And some of the key features that the BRAC Commission had was that it was composed of independent experts. So that gave politicians an additional layer of cover. Like, all these experts have identified that these bases must be closed, and it would allow them to fight against the base closures proposed by the independent commissioners and not have to take the political blame. So they could become advocates for their constituents and have, you know, a scapegoat to blame. The other key measure there was that members of Congress never had to affirmatively vote to close any of these military bases. By voting to put the commission process in place, they got to vote on the broader goal of we should close obsolete military bases without having to vote on the specific bases that would then be closed. And so there was actually a default mechanism where once the BRAC Commission reported out its list, it would go to Congress, a 45-day clock would start, where Congress could reject the commission's proposal, but they didn't ever had to affirmatively vote for it, and it would just go into effect. So I think that a mechanism like this will be most promising to address Medicare and Social Security reform, allow for political cover, and put in place a default adoption mechanism that allows politicians to keep their hands clean.
So Congress passes a bill which says there's a commission. How many people are usually on these commissions?
12 to 15 is usually a good number.
Okay, so you say you people on the commission, you go, you decide how to accomplish this goal, and then it automatically goes into force. And all Congress voted on was to create a commission.
That's right.
That would close military bases or deal with entitlements. And so this has worked for entitlements before?
So this type of commission in the United States has only been used for closing military bases. We have had deficit reduction and debt commissions in the past, like the Simpson-Bowles Commission, the super committee that came out of the Budget Control Act in 2011, and then going back all the way to 1983, the Greenspan Commission. But in those instances, those commissions actually did not work. They did come up with proposals, some of which helped to inform future debate, but the commission as envisioned was not able to execute on its objective. The Simpson-Bowles Commission came up with a plan, but it didn't pass Congress. The Greenspan Commission actually in 1983 failed to even agree on a plan, and it wasn't until basically the White House and a small group of legislators stepped in to avoid the automatic benefit cuts that in Social Security that were looming within weeks. It took that pressure in order to get a proposal across the table. And so some people say that the Greenspan Commission worked, but actually it did create room for negotiations, but the commission itself actually failed. And the super committee just failed miserably. They couldn't even come up with proposals among the commissioners. So in terms of like which commission has actually worked in U.S. history, you'd be hard pressed to find something as powerful as the Base Realignment and Closure Commission. And given how important it is to address the growth in Medicare and Social Security, and the potential consequences of failure to do so, and the high cost associated with delay until we are at those trust fund deadlines where there will be the political pressure to do something, I think that the BRAC model is the most promising model that has the highest chance of success. And so I think it's worth a try.
So those ones with entitlement, Simpson's Bowles and all that, sounds like they were structurally different. They didn't automatically go into effect. They didn't have that.
No, they didn't have that. And there were members of Congress, at least partially, made up the list of commissioners, and usually a majority of members of Congress made up the commissioners. So already there, you're losing the benefit of the BRAC Commission, the political cover a group of independent experts provides, because you're actually relying on elected officials to come up with the details for how these programs will be reformed. So that means that they're going to bear the blame. So they're going to be a lot more hesitant to do things that are politically unpopular, even in that context. And then, both chambers had to affirmatively vote for this proposal to go into effect. So now you have even more politicians that have to go on the record for potential benefit cuts and tax increases. And so again, you lose that layer of political cover that I think is necessary to do something as important and yet unpopular as reforming Medicare and Social Security.
Yeah. And so it seems like, it seems very different from the BRAC Commission, because it seems like that had a goal, which was close military bases, and then you just decide which to close. And there's an issue here. There's a substantive issue about cutting benefits or raising taxes and how much. So I it's hard to see. Yeah, it's sort of hard to imagine how you even write the mandate for that commission. Do you tell them, do you give them a percentage, like some percentage spending cuts and some percentage revenue increases? And that becomes a big problem, because that's a big political difference between Republicans and Democrats. This seems, the BRAC Commission sounds like a nice precedent in some ways, but there are unique difficulties here, aren't they?
There are. The current consensus, if you're looking at the Fiscal Commission Act, for example, which passed the House Budget Committee with bipartisan support, is to stabilize the debt as a percentage of GDP. In that approach, it would be 100% of GDP, or the size of the U.S. economy, over the next 15 years. We're roughly at 100% of GDP debt right now, and that is projected to grow to 170% of GDP roughly over the next 30 years. And so that basically says that we want to keep debt at the current percentage of the economy and not allow it to grow beyond that point indefinitely, which is the current trajectory that we're on. And then it leaves the details as to how you arrive at that to the commissioners to figure out. I would, however, say that any plan, even without Congress outright having to specify what percentage should be tax increases, what percentage should be spending cuts, ultimately is going to come down to being much more heavy on the spending reduction side, because there's a limit to how much you can raise in tax revenue. If you look at how much the U.S. has been able to raise over the past 50 years, historically, average revenues have been about 17.5% of GDP. Over the next 30 years, spending is projected to grow from the current roughly 23% of GDP to 30% of GDP. And there's no precedent for raising that amount of tax revenue in the U.S. context. You would have to add an entirely new layer of taxation that would primarily raise revenue from the middle class and lower income workers. Something like a value-added tax is what would be necessary to make that work. Right now, it doesn't seem like there's political consensus for huge tax increases on middle class and lower income Americans. So that might not be a political solution that could actually work out. What you hear from the left is that they want to raise taxes on the wealthiest Americans, which they define as people making $400,000 or more annually. And there, most experts agree that you might be able to get, you know, 1 to 1.5 percentage points more revenue out of that group. But then you're at maybe 19%. If the economy booms and you get about a bunch of capital gains tax revenue as well, maybe you get to a total of 20% of GDP. And that's the max you could raise with the current progressive tax system that we have in the United States. So the question then really is how much do you want to take from middle class and lower income Americans to create something more like a European style tax system in order to fund an ever-growing expansive welfare state? Because that's what it ultimately will take. The wealthy are not going to be able to pay for. There's just not enough money at the top to pay for the expansion and entitlements that is currently projected.
So if I'm a conservative and I just want spending cuts, maybe I just want to do nothing. I mean, it sounds like doing nothing is just going to get you spending cuts. Maybe that's the best option.
So under current law, doing nothing would result in 23% spending cuts to Social Security. Those would be implemented across the board. The Social Security Administration has no legal authority to pick and choose where that would come from. And so I don't think that's going to be a politically robust solution. I cannot see a politician on either side of the political spectrum going, that's fine. Because now you're actually, you are taking away resources that are essential for the poorest Americans.
But nobody will say it's fine, right? Like the Democrats will say these Republicans, they won't raise taxes. And the Republicans will introduce a bill that does something or other. And so there's nobody clearly to blame. Whoever's president probably just gets blamed automatically. But if you're a fiscal conservative, you say, fine, we'll point the finger at Democrat. We'll introduce our Republican bill. You introduce your Democrat bill and just fight over, who is the problem here.
I think what's more likely to happen is that both parties will agree to just borrow more money to avoid those automatic benefit cuts. And now you're opening the floodgates to, borrowing trillions more to support these programs. And I think that if you get that kind of an outcome, U.S. bondholders are going to react to that. Because you've basically said, we've given up, we are not going to curb the growth in these spending programs until you force us to, by refusing to buy treasury bonds or raising interest rates so high that we end up in a debt doom loop where we have to do something about it. And so bondholders and investors in U.S. treasuries will likely exert that type of pressure at that point, because anyone can view the fiscal situation of the United States, and you don't have to be a math whiz or an economist to realize that it's highly unsustainable. Penn Wharton is projecting that over the next 15 to 20 years, we're going to have a fiscal crisis if we don't change course, because their model can't even handle the model inputs beyond that, because it's just economically completely unsustainable. And so something will have to happen. I just worry that not addressing this sooner rather than later means that we have fewer options on the table. Right now, you can spread out the slowing of the growth in benefits. You don't even have to cut benefits. You just need to slow the growth in benefits. In both cases, in Medicare and Social Security, benefits are becoming more and more generous each and every year because of the formulas that govern the growth in those benefits. And those are automatic. Like, you could say that Congress abdicated its responsibility to control government spending when they put Social Security and Medicare on these automatic growth formulas that are not pegged to the ability of the economy or tax revenues to sustain the growth in these programs. They've only pegged, how much they're going to grow, but they haven't made provision to actually pay for that growth in benefits. That's the challenge that we face. But for example, in Social Security, you could close almost the entire unfunded obligation for Social Security if you just indexed initial benefits to prices rather than wages going forward. Because right now, initial benefits, if when you first apply to Social Security, you get this huge productivity boost credited to your Social Security benefits. And benefits that taxes that you paid in, say, 1980 get counted towards your benefits as if you earned them in 2024. And so, but you didn't pay those taxes and you didn't have those earnings at the time, but you get benefits as if you did. And so if we just froze the current benefit level and said, if you apply for benefits, then, you know, we're going to take all your wages and we're going to index them for inflation so that it's the current value of today rather than, you know, what you earned in 1980, then that would actually solve most of the unfunded obligation there. With Medicare, it's a little more complicated, but you could even say, let's take the current Medicare subsidy per person and provide that to individuals in the form of a check or a contribution to a health savings account, and then allow people to use that money. You don't even have to cut the size of the subsidy, just give it to them directly and allow them to buy insurance in the marketplace. And that would likely, very likely drive down cost growth in healthcare, because individuals would have a stake at figuring out what things cost, and to the degree that they can negotiate, especially with optional procedures, you'd get more price transparency and people would have an incentive to try and save on their own healthcare spending, because they could keep those amounts in their HSA and use for things like co-pays or deductibles going forward, or even for you know, broader retirement, since you can use funds that are in your HSA in retirement as well for any other outlays that you might have. So introducing more market forces in Medicare, I think, is going to be most effective. And then in Social Security, slowing the growth of benefits, reducing benefits for the highest income earners. I think those are two key proposals where you could get bipartisan support. It doesn't cut anyone's current benefits. It just makes them less generous over time.
Yeah, I didn't know that, or I knew it and I forgot that. Yeah, it's indexed to wages. So if we get economic growth, you think that's good news. It just makes it that price is worse. The fact that wages are going up just means we shove more money to old people. I mean, that's just that's incredible.
Yes.
Was this when did this become? Was it always like this, or did they make it like this later?
No, this was a change that came about in the 70s because we had very very high inflation at that time, and Social Security benefits had not been indexed to inflation. So anytime you had inflation, politicians had to basically vote to increase benefits, or they would automatically decline in their purchasing power. Mm-hmm. And during that period where they voted in place the cost of living adjustment in the 70s, they also indexed initial benefits to wages. And that's been like the worst decision in the history of the Social Security program, because it's been the largest driver, other than, you know, factors that are more out of your control, like the aging of society, demographic factors, the decline in fertility. The single most costliest policy decision on Social Security was indexing initial benefits to wages.
Interesting. And so, yeah, I mean, it doesn't seem that hard. It seems like it shouldn't be that hard to just say index, you know, 10 years down the line, index to prices rather than wages. Is there any movement? Are we going more broadly? Are we going in the wrong direction? Because there was more talk. You know, it gets worse the closer you get to 2032 or 2033. But it seems like we talk about Social Security and Medicare spending less today than we did around the time of the Tea Party, around 2010, 2011. Is what's going on behind the scenes like actually reflective of the public debate that we're all observing, or is there something else going on?
Yeah, it's gotten much, much worse. Not only is there less talk about reforming Social Security and Medicare than we saw, for example, when Paul Ryan was the Budget Committee Chairman and later Speaker of the House. But on the left, you've also seen now actual legislative proposals to significantly increase benefits. So instead of just fighting over, you know, not reducing benefits, now we have the left pushing to significantly increase them and do so across the board. And you have the Larson proposal there and the Sanders Warren proposal that would do that. So I think in part this could be a reflection of political parties just recognizing that as the American society ages even more, like I said, we're going from 15% of the U.S. population being 65 and older. That's generally your Medicare and Social Security eligible population, to 20% of the population being in that age category over just the next 5 years. And they disproportionately vote. So it seems politically profitable to say that you're going to protect their benefits and, you know, maybe you're going to increase their benefits and therefore gain gain their political support. So that's what I'm observing on the political side, is that both parties are trying to get as many of that older voting population to vote for their camp, and they're willing to disregard, you know, the fiscal and economic realities in order to promise higher benefits or suggest that, you know, doing nothing is an option, which it is not.
Yeah. I don't know how much of this is necessarily tied to the population aging. It just seems like the left has just doesn't care about budgets anymore and is not really plugged into sort of fiscal reality. So it just seems like they're doing this on sort of every issue. But yeah, from what you say, it sounds like Paul Ryan was the, I tell people, the one sort of the one honorable man in Washington. And it doesn't get nearly as much appreciation for it as he deserves.
He really tried. I think you make a valid point there. And I just want to add that one reason this might be the case, just as the economist Keynes caused a cultural shift in U.S. policy after World War II, from a stance of, we are a country that pays its bills, that tries to pay down its debt, to one where deficits were seen as a tool to stimulate the economy and a good thing. And you had, you know, discussions of multiplier effects, how if the government just spent more money, it could, you know, potentially create more jobs and incomes. And Keynes was really effective at selling this to politicians at the time, which is, I think, explains a lot of where we are today. And most recently, you have this theory called modern monetary theory that tries to tell politicians that they don't need to worry about, you know, the debt at all, because they can just print more money, that a country that has a sovereign currency can never run out of money because it could just create more of it. And that what they often leave out of the discussion is that there is still a limit on what the government can spend. That limit is just inflation, rather than tax revenue. But there's still, you know, economic reality still holds. But that has become much more popular on the left. We saw former chairman of the House Budget Committee Yarmouth testify before Congress last fall. This was about the fiscal commission, where he said that we shouldn't even worry about how much we borrow or pay in interest on the debt, because we can just print more money. So I think that's maybe another reason why you see the left saying, well, we'll just spend on whatever and just make the Federal Reserve figure out how to pay for it, without mentioning that this is going to cause inflation, which ultimately is just a hidden form of taxation, and a particularly troublesome one, because higher income individuals tend to more likely have assets like real estate and stocks that tend to take inflation into account, rise with inflation, so they're not necessarily worse off after the inflation episode. But anyone who keeps their money in a savings account, or whose wages don't grow as fast as inflation, ends up paying that tax, because they'll have to work more just to maintain the current standard of living.
Yeah, yeah. What are these MMT people? What do they say about Zimbabwe? I mean, what do they say about these sort of examples of countries that have taken their advice?
Yeah, or Venezuela. Someone should ask them. They tend to not really talk about the inflationary trade-off that you inevitably make when you decide to just monetize your spending or debt and use your central bank as your piggy bank.
Yeah. Okay. That's all interesting for me. I'm going to link to your material. I want to ask you before we go, how did you get into this topic? Because it's not budget, debts, and entitlement. This is not, you know, maybe the sexiest public policy issue that most people are interested in. When I write about this stuff, it usually gets a lot less attention than a lot of my other writing. And I'm actually, I get disappointed by that. And I wish people would pay attention to sort of what's happening with the fiscal crisis. So how did you get into this? Sort of what's your background before you became a policy wonk?
Well, I got into economics because I was trying to understand why some countries are rich and others are poor. And I had a very personal experience there growing up in Germany, which was, you know, one of the wealthiest nations of Europe. And my family was coming from southern Italy and just going to visit them in the summers and seeing, you know, how they lived versus how we lived, just recognizing those discrepancies. But I got into fiscal policy because fiscal policy is the foundation of your economy and the stability of your country over the long term. And so I guess I recognize that it's not as popular in the policy world. If you want to be popular, you work on tax cuts. And you certainly see a lot of people working there or in more culturally charged issues. But I think this is one of the most important issues that I can be working on to preserve the United States as a free and prosperous country that allows people to get ahead. And I fundamentally believe, as an immigrant myself, in the power of the American dream. And I know what it's done for me. And I want to preserve that dream for more Americans. And I don't think that's possible if we don't have a fiscally responsible government that maintains a sustainable policy. Because during major financial crises, it tends to be more vulnerable individuals that end up worse off. Same is true for inflation. So I'm trying to preserve that opportunity and that economic opportunity for people to be able to get ahead and make something of themselves. If they're willing to work hard and with a little bit of luck, they can do that in this country still.
Yeah, that's beautiful. And how did you, what's the mechanics of how you, what did you study in school? How did you get hired in Heritage? Like sort of how did you break into this world?
Yes. So I went to George Mason University. And that was an ideal breeding ground for understanding economics in the context of public policy. The school really focuses on that. And then I came across the Foundation for Economic Education, and that they did a seminar at George Mason, and that really fundamentally influenced my thinking on the role of government in society. And I read a book called Bastiat's The Law, which made me think very differently about what is the role of government in protecting rights and how does redistributing money and resources from one group of citizens to another violate that that foundation of property rights protection. And then I did internships in some policy organizations, including the Cato Institute, ended up at Heritage because they had a pipeline to grow talent from research assistants to policy analysts and beyond. And I had a good career at Heritage, and I got to do very impactful work, particularly during the Trump administration. Heritage was really at the center of advising the administration on policies. We wrote a lot of the content that ended up in the presidential budget proposal. So that was a very powerful way of influencing a current policy at the time. Things changed with the pandemic. Nobody cared about spending. Yeah, there was no consideration for inflation. It was just like, spend money as quickly as possible, which I found deeply troubling. And I left policy at that time and did a private sector stint helping highly influential business leaders and other influencers to learn from each other and help each other grow at running an executive leadership network. And then as the window of opportunity opened up again to make headway on fiscal reform due to the high inflation and it being driven in a large part by spending and Federal Reserve policy, I saw an opportunity to make a difference. And so I came to Cato where I've been pushing for this fiscal commission. And we've made a lot of headway. I mean, the fact that during an election year, you have bipartisan support for a fiscal commission that passed the House Budget Committee, I think is a strong indicator that politicians are feeling at least some pressure to signal that they're willing to address the debt problem. They recognize that there's a problem and they want to put in place a mechanism to actually resolve it. So I'm going to keep pushing because we don't really have another option. It is, we're in a highly precarious fiscal situation that we will need to address because it's just going to get automatically worse. So thank you for the opportunity to talk about that with you today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like, young people listen to this and sometimes they ask me what they should be doing. And I tell them if they're choosing between academia and something else, I say, think about think tank, think about the policy space, because hearing your story is a reminder, there's opportunities out there. Usually you don't need a PhD, right? Most people in think tanks don't have PhDs. Some of them do, but you don't have to spend 8 more years in school and you could be doing very interesting work and you could be relevant and you could have a policy influence. So I'm glad you were able to tell your story. And thanks for being here, Romina. Is there anything you want to plug before we go?
Just that I invite your listeners to sign up for my Substack, The Debt Dispatch. It's currently free. And they'll get links to the most relevant fiscal and debt developments, as well as original commentary from me and my team every week directly in their inbox. So The Debt Dispatch on Substack.
Yeah, and we'll put the link in the show notes. I read every post, so highly recommend it.
Thank you, Richard.